I'm Deanne Penn with UN News. Although women make up half the global population, they are often disregarded in the increasingly important world of big data, from measuring economic growth to disaster response and recovery, or key public transportation planning, an award-winning author said at the United Nations on Friday. Caroline Criado Perez shared some of the findings from her book, Invisible Women: Data Bias in a World Designed for Men, during a presentation at the UN Bookshop in New York, following a morning retreat with senior leaders focused on gender equality. Nala Valji, the UN's first senior gender advisor in the Executive Office of the Secretary General, asked Ms. Criado Perez what inspired her to write the book and how the global organization can learn from her research on default male bias.
The book came about because of how I became a feminist. How I became a feminist was I discovered that default male was going on in my own head. Prior to that, I'd actually been pretty hostile to feminism. I thought that women had equality and that feminism was just an excuse for women to be able to complain about them not really putting in the effort, them not choosing to strive, them not being interested in, you know, politics, in leadership. I had a very low opinion of my sex, and it wasn't until I went to university as a mature student when I was 25 that I really had to engage with ideas of gender. And so I started thinking about the representation of women. And I started thinking about how I had been taught basically about men all my life. The history I'd learned was about men. The books I was told to read were by men and about men. When I was taught about science, it was presented to me as if all the discoveries ever had been made by men. And so I started to think, well, if you look at it that way, is it any surprise that I have this low opinion of women? So I got very interested in how important it was for women to see women so that they didn't internalize this misogyny that our culture is so infested with. But then I started to see that actually it existed in these more, even more damaging ways. I mean, I think obviously it's very damaging for women's sense of self, but, you know, then I started noticing, well, this actually is how our entire economy is structured, for example. GDP, this number that we hold up as the representation of the economy, this is what's going on. It is a number that we don't question. This is how big the economy in this country is. And yet it's missing the entire amount of unpaid work that women do, which is a huge contributor to the economy and without which the formal economy would not function. You know, it requires that childcare is done, that the house is cleaned, that the groceries are picked up, that the clothes are washed, that lunch is made. You know, all these things that happen invisibly actually have an economic value. And in fact, when, you know, the decision was being made about what GDP was going to look like, there was a discussion about whether women's unpaid work should be included. You know, it's never been disputed that it has an economic value, but ultimately it was decided, and this is a really repeated theme I came across in my research, that it was too complicated to measure. And that really is something that came up again and again and again. Women are just too complicated. Our bodies are too complicated. Our work patterns are too complicated. Our travel patterns are too complicated. Everything about us is too complicated. And then I discovered refugee policy. So the UN Declaration on Refugees, which is obviously this incredibly historic, important document, which was drawn up with the best of intentions, you know, after World War II, the idea being that no one should ever be rendered stateless again and that you shouldn't have to stay in a country where you're being persecuted. But when you look at this, you know, gender-neutral, presented in a gender-neutral way document, you realise that there are all these stipulations that will affect men and women differently. For example, having to flee the country that you are being persecuted in before you can claim asylum. Well, that's so much more difficult for a woman than a man. And what if the person that she's being persecuted by is the person who's meant to be accompanying her? Then if a woman even does manage to leave, you know, you can't just rock up and say, hey, I'm being persecuted, give me asylum. You have to be able to prove that you're being persecuted for a set number of reasons. And those include, you know, sexuality, political affiliation. But the number one reason that women will give you for why they're being persecuted is because they're a woman. You know, if you talk about something like FGM, that's not because of their political belief. That's because they're female. So you are here at the United Nations, and of course, refugee work, humanitarian assistance, development, peace and security, these are all critical areas of the work that the UN does. And you write specifically about peace and security in post-conflict. Mm-hmm. You also write about post-disaster rebuilding. Can you tell us a little bit about what are the implications of the male default bias with regards to post-conflict recovery, with regards to disaster and post-disaster? And what does that mean for our work?
One of the frustrations about post-conflict and post-disaster is that there is a sort of general consensus often that we're in a crisis, okay? Can the ladies just shut up and let us get on with it, you know? This idea that gender is a distraction from, you know, the main issue, that it's this little side thing that we can deal with later. You know, there's that sort of very famous phrase, you know, we'll get to the women after the revolution. And that's basically the way that we seem to often act in a crisis mode. We retrench, we go back to traditional ways of doing things. You know, if you don't think about it very hard, it seems reasonable. Yes, we've got more important things to be worrying about than whether the women are included. Like, we're trying to save lives here. The problem with that is that lives are more likely to be lost if you don't address gender in these moments, because actually women's lives are most vulnerable in a post-conflict situation and most vulnerable in a disaster situation. And that is not because women are inherently weaker. It's because the societies that we live in position women in ways that mean they are less likely to be able to survive and they're more likely to be heavily impacted. For example, the cyclones in, where was it? I think it was in Bangladesh. I interviewed for the book a disaster relief specialist, and she was explaining to me why women were more likely to die. And it was this series of things that had nothing to do with with, you know, biologically. It was all to do with social reasons. So first of all, women weren't even getting the warning, the cyclone warning. Why? Because the cyclone warnings were in public spaces. And so the women were reliant on the men to come back and say, hey, there's a cyclone, you better get to the shelter. And they weren't getting the message. It was as simple as that. They just didn't know. Second, the cyclone shelters themselves were not built with an idea about gender. So they were just these big spaces, mixed sex, and if the women went in there, they were getting sexually assaulted. They were seen as easy women because they're mixing with the men. Or they wouldn't go in there because they didn't want to have a bad reputation. You know, they had to choose between saving my life or saving my reputation, which can be the same as saving your life after you've survived. Is it worth surviving if you're going to be ostracized for the rest of your life? They didn't provide animal shelters in these cyclone spaces, and animals were the responsibility of the women, and so the women would stay to look after the animals. And then after, in the disaster relief after the cyclone, they built these homes, and they built them without kitchens, and they built them without animal shelters. Again, you know, both these areas that women are responsible for. And so you see from the beginning to the end, from, you know, surviving the cyclone to being able to live in the post-disaster scenario, if you haven't accounted for gender, all these ridiculous things happen that make women more likely to die or make them unable to pick up their lives and carry on afterward.
So you say in the book that there are three ways in which the male default bias misses the experiences of women. Mm-hmm. One is women's experiences of violence. Mm-hmm. The other is the fact that women give birth. And the third is unpaid care work. Mm-hmm. And this morning in the retreat, you gave an example of the way in which missing the unpaid care work implicates itself in policy, and as a result of that, in public transportation policy. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The example that I was talking about was to illustrate the importance of not just collecting sex disaggregated data, but it's also really important how you analyze it and to question the assumptions that you may have before you start to analyze the data. So in transport, the traditional way that transport data has been segregated has been transport per paid employment is all put together in one big block. And then you have all these other sections like, you know, transport for education, transport for shopping, transport for escorting, And what this transport planner in Madrid realized was that what was happening there was that all the travel that women did for their unpaid care work was being split up into these separate categories and mixed up with leisure travel. And women's unpaid care work travel is lost in all those smaller areas. And you've got, so, you know, women going grocery shopping, which is unpaid care work, is mixed up with, like, I don't know, some guy going and buying a sports car. Anyway, so what she did was she took the unpaid care work travel that was separated out and mixed in with the leisure travel, and she put it all together in one block as well. And she found, therefore, that there was almost as much travel for women's unpaid care work as there was for paid employment. And also, it was the number one reason that women were travelling. The unpaid care work has to get done. You know, it's non-negotiable. And the reality is that it is mainly still women doing it. Women do 75% of the world's unpaid care work. They do something like three times as much childcare, four times as much housework. And unless you account for it in your infrastructure, that is your public transport, but it's also, you know, your zoning, you know, where is the business district, where is the residential district, where are the doctor's surgeries, you aren't helping women to combine their paid and unpaid work. And if you don't help women to do that, they drop out of the paid employment system.